Chapter 14. A backsheesh here and there. I landed one morning at the Seraglio Point from Galata, close by an ancient pleasure house of the defunct Sultan, a vast broad-brimmed pavilion that looks agreeable enough to be a dancing room for ghosts now. There is another summer house, the guidebook cheerfully says, whither the Sultan goes to sport with his women and mutes. A regiment of infantry, with their music at their head, were marching to exercise in the outer grounds of the Seraglio, and we followed them, and had an opportunity of seeing their evolutions, and hearing their bands, upon a fine green plain under the Seraglio walls, where stands one solitary column, erected in memory of some triumph of some Byzantine emperor. There were three battalions of the Turkish infantry, exercising here, and they seemed to perform their evolutions in a very satisfactory manner. That is, they fired all together, and charged and halted in very straight lines, and bit off imaginary cartridge tops with great fierceness and regularity, and made all their ramrods ring to measure, just like so many Christians. The men looked small, young, clumsy, and ill-built, uncomfortable in their shabby European clothes, and about the legs, especially, seemed exceedingly weak and ill-formed. Some score of military invalids were lolling in the sunshine, about a fountain and a marble summer house that stand on the ground, watching their comrades' maneuvers as if they could never have enough of that delightful pastime, and the sick were much better cared for than their healthy companions. Each man had two dressing gowns, one of white cotton, and an outer wrapper of warm brown woolen. Their heads were accommodated with wadded cotton nightcaps, and it seemed to me, from their condition, and from the excellent character of the military hospitals, that it would be much more wholesome to be ill than to be well in the Turkish service. Facing this green esplanade, and the Bosphorus shining beyond it, rise the great walls of the outer Seraglio Gardens. Huge masses of ancient masonry, over which peep the roofs of numerous kiosks and outhouses, amongst thick evergreens, planted so as to hide the beautiful frequenters of the place from the prying eyes and telescopes. We could not catch a glance of a single figure moving in these great pleasure grounds. The road winds round the walls, and the outer park, which is likewise planted with trees, and diversified by garden plots and cottages, had more the air of the outbuildings of a homely English park than of a palace which we must all have imagined to be the most stately in the world. The most commonplace water carts were passing here and there, roads were being repaired in the macadamite manner, and carpenters were mending the park palings, just as they do in Hampshire. The next thing you might fancy would be the Sultan walking out with a spud and a couple of dogs, on the way to meet the post bag and the St. James Chronicle. The palace is no palace at all. It is a great town of pavilions, built without order, here and there, according to the fancy of succeeding lights of the universe, or their favorites. The only row of domes which looked particularly regular or stately were the kitchens. As you examined the buildings, they had a ruinous, dilapidated look. They are not furnished, it is said, with particular splendor, not a bit more elegantly than Miss Jones' Seminary for Young Ladies, which we may be sure is much more comfortable than the extensive establishment of His Highness Abdul-Mejid. In the little stable I thought to see some marks of royal magnificence, and some horses worthy of the King of all Kings. But the Sultan is said to be a very timid horseman. The animal that is always kept saddled for him did not look to be worth £20, and the rest of the horses, in the shabby dirty stalls, were small, ill-kept common-looking brutes. You might see better, it seemed to me, at a country inn stable on any market day. The kitchens are the most sublime part of the Seraglio. There are 9 of these great halls, for all ranks, from His Highness downwards, where many hecatombs are roasted daily, according to the accounts, and where cooking goes on with a savage Homeric grandeur. Chimneys are despised in these primitive halls, so that the roofs are black with the smoke of hundreds of furnaces, which escapes through apertures in the domes above. These two give the chief light in the rooms, which streams downwards, and thickens and mingles with the smoke, and so murkily lights up hundreds of swarthy figures busy about the spits and the cauldrons. Close to the door by which we entered they were making pastry for the sultanas, and the chief pastry cook, who knew my guide, invited us courteously to see the process, and partake of the delicacies prepared for those charming lips. How those sweet lips must shine, after eating these puffs. First, huge sheets of dough are rolled out till the paste is about as thin as silver paper. Then an artist forms the dough muslin into a sort of drapery, curling it round and round in many fanciful and pretty shapes, until it is all got into the circumference of a round metal tray in which it is baked. Then the cake is drenched in grease most profusely, and, finally, a quantity of syrup is poured over it, when the delectable mixture is complete. The moon-faced ones are said to devour immense quantities of this wholesome food, and, in fact, are eating grease and sweetmeats from morning till night. I don't like to think what the consequences may be, or allude to the agonies which the delicate creatures must inevitably suffer. The good-natured chief pastry cook filled a copper basin with greasy puffs, and, dipping a dubious ladle into a large cauldron, containing several gallons of syrup, poured a liberal portion over the cakes, and invited us to eat. One of the tarts was quite enough for me, and I excused myself on the plea of ill health from imbibing any more grease and sugar. But my companion, the dragoman, finished some 40 puffs in a twinkling. They slipped down his open jaws as the sausages do down clowns' throats in a pantomime. His mustaches shone with grease, and it dripped down his beard and fingers. We thanked the smiling chief pastry cook, and rewarded him handsomely for the tarts. It is something to have eaten of the dainties prepared for the ladies of the harem, but I think Mr. Cockle ought to get the names of the chief sultanas among the exalted patrons of his antibilious pills. From the kitchens we passed into the second court of the seraglio, beyond which is death. The guidebook only hints at the dangers which would befall a stranger caught prying in the mysterious first court of the palace. I have read Bluebeard, and don't care for peeping into forbidden doors, so that the second court was quite enough for me, the pleasure of beholding it being heightened, as it were, by the notion of the invisible danger sitting next door, with uplifted scimitar ready to fall on you present though not seen. A cloister runs along one side of this court. Opposite is the hall of the Divan, large but low, covered with lead, and gilt, after the Moorish manner, plain enough. The Grand Vizier sits in this place, and the ambassadors used to wait here, and be conducted hence on horseback, attired with robes of honor. But the ceremony is now, I believe, discontinued. The English envoy, at any rate, is not allowed to receive any backsheesh, and goes away as he came, in the habit of his own nation. On the right, is a door leading into the interior of the seraglio. None pass through it, but such as are sent for, the guidebook says. It is impossible to top the terror of that description. About this door lads and servants were lolling, itchoglins and pages, with lazy looks and shabby dresses, and among them, sunning himself sulkily on a bench, a poor old fat, wrinkled, dismal white eunuch, with little fat white hands, and a great head sunk into his chest, and two sprawling little legs, that seemed incapable to hold up his bloated old body. He squeaked out some surly reply to my friend the dragoman, who, softened and sweetened by the tarts he had just been devouring, was, no doubt, anxious to be polite. And the poor worthy fellow walked away rather crestfallen at this return of his salutation, and hastened me out of the place. The palace of the seraglio, the cloister with marble pillars, the hall of the ambassadors, the impenetrable gate guarded by eunuchs and itchoglins, have a romantic look in print, but not so in reality. Most of the marble is wood, almost all the gilding is faded, the guards are shabby, the foolish perspectives painted on the walls are half cracked off. The place looks like Vauxhall in the daytime. We passed out of the second court under the Sublime Port, which is like a fortified gate of a German town of the Middle Ages, into the outer court, round which are public offices, hospitals, and dwellings of the multifarious servants of the palace. This place is very wide and picturesque. There is a pretty church of Byzantine architecture at the further end, and in the midst of the court a magnificent plane tree, of prodigious dimensions and fabulous age according to the guides. St. Sophia towers in the further distance. And from here, perhaps, is the best view of its light-swelling domes and beautiful proportions. The port itself, too, forms an excellent subject for the sketcher, if the officers of the court will permit him to design it. I made the attempt, and a couple of Turkish beadles looked on very good-naturedly for some time at the progress of the drawing, but a good number of other spectators speedily joined them, and made a crowd, which is not permitted, it would seem, in the Seraglio. So I was told to pack up my portfolio, and remove the cause of the disturbance, and lost my drawing of the Ottoman port. I don't think I have anything more to say about the city which has not been much better told by graver travelers. I, with them, could see, perhaps it was the preaching of the politicians, that warned me of the fact that we are looking on at the last days of an empire, and heard many stories of weakness, disorder, and oppression. I even saw a Turkish lady drive up to Sultan Achmet's mosque in Abroam. Is not that a subject to moralize upon? And might one not draw endless conclusions from it, that the knell of the Turkish dominion is rung, that the European spirit and institutions once admitted can never be rooted out again, and that the skepticism prevalent amongst the higher orders must descend ere very long to the lower, and the cry of the muezzin from the mosque become a mere ceremony? But as I only stayed 8 days in this place, and knew not a syllable of the language, perhaps it is as well to pretermine any disquisitions about the spirit of the people. I can only say that they look to be very good-natured, handsome, and lazy, that the women's yellow slippers are very ugly, that the kebabs at the shop hard by the rope bazaar are very hot and good, and that at the Armenian cookshops they serve you delicious fish, and a stout raisin wine of no small merit. There came in, as we sat and dined there at sunset, a good old Turk, who called for a penny fish, and sat down under a tree very humbly, and ate it with his own bread. We made that jolly old Muslim happy with a quart of the raisin wine, and his eyes twinkled with every fresh glass, and he wiped his old beard delighted, and talked and chirped a good deal, and, I dare say, told us the whole state of the empire. He was the only Muslim with whom I attained any degree of intimacy during my stay in Constantinople, and you will see that, for obvious reasons, I cannot divulge the particulars of our conversation. You have nothing to say, and you own it, says somebody. Henry Wright? That question perhaps between ourselves, I have put likewise. And yet, my dear sir, there are some things worth remembering even in this brief letter. That woman in the brougham is an idea of significance. That comparison of the Seraglio to Vauxhall in the daytime is a true and real one, from both of which your own great soul and ingenious philosophic spirit may draw conclusions that I myself have modestly forborne to press. You are too clever to require a moral, to be tacked to all the fables you read, as is done for children in the spelling books, else I would tell you that the government of the Ottoman port seems to be as rotten, as wrinkled, and as feeble as the old eunuch I saw crawling about it in the sun. That when the lady drove up in a brougham to Sultan Achmet, I felt that the schoolmaster was really abroad, and that the crescent will go out before that luminary, as meekly as the moon does before the sun. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.